Good evening and welcome to the Tuesday, October 26, 2010 Carver Board of Aldermen meeting. This is a public hearing meeting and we have three public hearings scheduled. We have a couple of brief resolutions that I think board members have brought tonight. Do you want to go first?
Sure. Thank you, Mark. Good evening. Many of you know that the Board of County Commissioners closed the Carmel Dental Clinic, and Southern Orange folks have been really concerned about it, about the loss and the consolidation of the dental clinic. So do you want me to, how far do you want me to read, or just give us?
Why don't you give the name of it?
So the name is Resolution in Opposition to the Closure of the Carmel Dental Clinic and Recommendation to Repeal the Closure. And I just want to say that Penny Ridge, the town of Chapel Hill, is also taking a similar resolution to her town council this week. So ours is a little bit different because Carmel's our home turf, but
yes.
Message is the same.
Randy, thank you for introducing this, and I'd like to second it.
All right.
Thanks, Randy.
Thanks, Randy.
Yeah,
thank
you,
Randy,
for working on this issue, Randy. All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor of the resolution signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Can I make a suggestion to the board?
Yes.
That we kind of revisit this in a year to determine what has occurred since then, only because people won't pay attention, and we could get the information from Piedmont Health Services and UNC mm-hmm. Dentistry to determine whether or not the true absorption that they said would do, because they always talk about consolidation works and all that kind of stuff. So that would be my suggestion, if staff could put a little tickler so next year this time we can ask the mm-hmm. pertinent question.
I have a question in regard to that.
Mm-hmm.
So the clinic is supposed to close July 1st, is my understanding. So are you wanting data about what the impact of that turns out to be on patients?
I think so.
Okay. So I'm wondering if 3 or 4 months is sufficient time to gauge that. I mean, it surely would be, at least for a preliminary.
It could be preliminary, and then you could revisit it in 2012. I'm just saying, I think we need to, part of what happens is we pass these resolutions, and mm-hmm. then until somebody has really big difficulty, and what I'm saying at the front end, kind of monitor it so that we can have the information. If we need to do another resolution in a year, we'll do another resolution, which will have more facts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes sense.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Sammy, is this your resolution?
Yes. So as promised during the last meeting, I said I would bring a resolution speaking to the kind of economic development that the town of Carbo would like to see if the quarter cent sales tax were to be passed in this referendum. So it's a resolution. The title is a resolution to request that the county commissioners allocate the economic development component of the quarter cent sales tax towards further establishing a local living economy and prioritizing economic development that can advance county and municipality goals and challenges. It's a rather long title, but the main point is that we, in as much as we're in an economic downturn and support from local, state, and federal agencies is waning, we would do best if we could recognize the potential use of this kind of economic development and prioritize it towards resolving issues that we have locally, such as dealing with climate change through energy efficiency programs, which have also happened to be really proven ways of stimulating the economy, but also a method in which we could potentially extend the lifetime of our landfill, and there are opportunities and savings there. So that's the gist of it.
Second.
What's the difference between those two?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Catherine thankfully provided the one I had sent earlier, and I didn't realize that she was on top of it, or that's my bad. They're very good. Thanks,
so are
Catherine.
They the same?
They're the same except for percentage. There's some typos, like one at the end, 42.5%. I was missing the percent sign.
Yours or the clerk's?
Mine.
Of course.
So
need your question.
I've corrected them, and I've already, Catherine and I have already talked, and I'll forward her the newest version.
Okay.
So which version did I second?
Yeah, presumably the
correct one.
The one that doesn't have anything on the back.
Okay, that's what I'm looking at. Great. All
right. The one that doesn't have a typo.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Kind of passes unanimously. Thanks for doing that, Sam.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we are on to our consent agenda.
We only have other matters.
There's no consent agenda.
Oh, really? Online it shows a... I see other matters. Okay, it shows it as consent agenda online. It's wrong. I wondered how that could be consent agenda, really. But
that's right.
In any case, the next item is Carrboro Centennial Celebration funding request. Yes, ma'am.
I would like to report that there's not a lot to report yet. The committee will be meeting again soon on a Wednesday that has yet to be determined. At that committee meeting, I've been talking to some members of the committee and some members of the community and you all. I am going to propose that a subcommittee be formed to address the actual centennial, the third, March 3rd. And so there are no funding requests yet since we don't know what that will involve. I'm envisioning something almost like the kind of assemblies that we had when we were in grade school that really wouldn't cost a lot, but that would mark the day. Mm-hmm. And kind of the party stuff would happen throughout the spring and on Carrboro Day, but that day be, you know, kind of serious. And Lydia and I have met with and at Lydia's Lydia organized a meeting with some women who do documentaries and on and have done some interesting stuff, and they are proposing that day taking pictures of people's pictures, scanning people's pictures, and making a film out of that. They are also looking for some funding to help do that. So there are things still up in the air. I would like as much involvement from this board as possible. One of the things I'm going to ask the to-be-formed subcommittee to do is to ask you, Mark, to contact the schools and ask that the schools in Carrboro be involved. Mm-hmm. Because I think this is really a, you know, kind of honoring our past, greeting our future kind of thing. So
yeah,
hopefully they'll be
excited to do it.
Yeah, I think I even thought, and this is just my own thing, it'd be so cool to have kids write letters to their grandkids and put them in a time capsule.
You said that. I love that.
Wouldn't that be kind of
that would be great.
It's my only idea, so I'll repeat it again. Yeah.
We still like it.
Yeah. Right.
Yes, still good.
I'd like to suggest two ideas that the committee would sort of consider. One is with the schools, maybe have like a poetry contest or an essay contest. And you could have one for elementary school, middle school, and high school, because we have all those three in Carrboro.
Cool.
And maybe, I'm sort of like the Arts Committee, maybe if they want to, at the end of the, also along with the poetry, to think about maybe an art contest or
an art show.
An art show of what students and also the greater community, if they wanted to submit something, what they thought 100 years means to Carrboro.
Hmm. Oh, cool.
And then my only other thing, because digital technology is, it's only three, digital technology is so interchangeable in some ways, and you can share it a lot easier than when I was young. I'm seasoned now. I'm not as young as I used to be, but I'm not old. That consider having people do, as was suggested with this, do their own videos and submit them.
Hmm.
Not just identify the Carver 100, but if people are interested, you know, for example, you could have some people interview people who've lived in Carver all their lives, and the changes that they've seen, people who just moved here, and just kind of, you know, that kind of thing. And then they could share those, and that could be part of it as well.
Yeah. So, so a real grassroots.
Yeah, just to get as much, you know, participation.
Yeah, that, Joel, some of what you said, I think would kind of fit into this idea that these folks are wanting to put together, because they talked about having, you know, not only people be able to email pictures and videos,
right,
but also they would meet with people like Richard and people that have the history of Carborough and talk with them about, you know, what they have and scan what they have, and even have an area where just, you know, regular citizens can come and just kind of speak and right, end up cutting that tape and putting it into the documentary.
It's like that idea that they do on NPR where the people come and they, what's that thing called?
Oh, My Story.
Yeah. My Story Corps. Right.
Yeah, Story Corps.
Yeah. Carborough Story Corps.
So that's, yes, I think that's part of this whole idea. So thanks.
You're
it's
welcome.
Exciting, and I will keep you posted and let you know if and when we need any money. Mark, you look pensive.
No, I'm just thinking about when exactly we would decide on that. We need to, you know.
I know.
We probably need to set a budget before, you know, before we go on break in December, for example.
Well, I'm hoping that the board will, that the committee will meet soon, and the subcommittee can be formed. But, you know, I don't think it's too soon to contact the schools and ask for some kind of participation.
Yeah, they need to get this stuff on their radar right away.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Thank you, Lydia and Jackie. It's exciting.
I believe that
there's no motion
on the public hearing item B1, continuation of public hearing on Jordan Buffer Rule.
As indicated, this is a continuation of a public hearing dealing with stream buffers in accordance with the Jordan Lake Buffer Rules, and you have a draft ordinance before you, and Trish McGuire, Planning Administrator, has a brief presentation to give you all the highlights of the changes.
Good evening, everyone. This public hearing is continued from January of this year, and it follows on some action that the board took in March of 2009, at which time the town revised its buffer regulations, and we changed our sort of approach from calling them stream buffers to specifically identifying water quality as an important goal of those buffers. We did that for a number of reasons, which we went into in detail at that time, but one part of the changes was a result of the, at that point, pending Jordan Lake rule, which was later adopted in 2009 and signed into law at the end of August last summer. There are a series of schedules and various things that we have to do to comply with those rules, the first of which was submitting a report in December of last year on how we would move forward with the compliance. And then the next step was adoption of our buffer regulations that were consistent with the rule. The Division of Water Quality put out a model ordinance last fall, and while we had prepared our ordinance provisions based on the rule itself, there's a lot of parallels, but also differences. As a result, it took a couple of rounds of review by the Division of Water Quality staff and changes by the town to make sure our ordinance included all of the provisions that were needed for it to be in compliance with the Jordan rule. And what we have before you is an ordinance that has been approved by the Water Quality Committee and the EMC, and it is ready to be, the changes essentially to what we adopted last year are ready to be approved by the town. So in summary, the changes that we have in this ordinance, well, let me just note that the ordinance itself actually presents all of the elements of our water quality buffers as we presented them to you last March. The underlying text in the document are the changes that have resulted from these review and modification that we've gone through with the staff of the DWQ and the EMC. So, but just in brief, the changes are as follows. We do add to the title of 15269 the terms purpose and applicability in addition to findings. We clarify those provisions as far as this ordinance goes. We add the definitions of several new terms. We clarify that the rule or these provisions affect disturbance that's both within these buffers as well as outside of them if it has an effect on what's happening inside the buffers. There's a mapping reference to the process for updating the stream maps upon which our buffers, the Jordan Rule buffers, our buffers and the Jordan Rule buffers are based. It modifies some language as to how stream determinations are to be made and what the qualifications are for the folks making them, as well as what will happen if there is a dispute over a stream determination. There's a modification to the method for measuring buffer widths on ephemeral streams. Ephemeral streams are not required to be buffered by the Jordan Rules, but we have continued with that approach that the town established many years ago in these regulations so that we go further in terms of protecting water quality. The ordinance clarifies that a written authorization of allowable uses is needed from the town, and this is specifically a need to clarify this when an activity is occurring outside of the issuance of some type of land use permit. The draft ordinance revises the table of exempt and allowable uses related to stream location, stream restoration, stream back stabilization, as well as several other changes dealing with access and wildlife passage structures and several other things. There is a change or a couple of changes to the part of the ordinance that deals with the determination of no practical alternatives and the timing of that decision, which in the case of activities that the town will be reviewing has to occur within 60 days or there are some other procedures that have to take place in order for a determination to affect the outcome. And specifies that any appeals of these determinations go to the Division of Water Quality Director. There are revisions to the sections on mitigation related to the purpose of mitigation, the options for meeting the mitigation determinations, donations of property, documentation, et cetera. And there are changes, there's a change to the major variance requirements, clarifying what are major variances in town and what are notice to the EMC. Has to be. Oh, that was on the second page. Sorry, I didn't switch to that one. The ordinance has been reviewed by Orange County. That was the version that back in January, actually, they found it no change. These are all procedural requirements or substantive changes and procedural changes that are resulting from the rule review. We didn't resubmit it to the county. The planning board, we did take this back to because they specifically, when they did their review, associated with the public hearing in January, wanted to see the ordinance when it was finalized. And so we brought it back to them earlier this month, and they've recommended approval of the ordinance. As is noted in the agenda item, there is expected to be some increases in staff time associated with some of these changes in the review of certain projects because of this clarification of the applicability of the regulations. That is to say that DWQ will actually review some of the permit, the buffer provisions for some circumstances. The referral of disputes over stream determinations to DWQ, of course, is something also that will happen out of our house, as it were. And the appeal of no practical alternatives, again, to the DWQ is a time, a step that we will not have control over in-house and may add to the timing of or the time it takes for projects to be reviewed. Happy to try and answer any questions.
Trish, can you remind me of the difference between Zone 1 width and Zone 2 width?
Sure. It varies based on the area of town. whether it's within the University Lake watershed or outside the watershed. But if you look at page B7,
yeah, I see watershed and outside of watershed under zone 1 and under zone 2. So what's
that? That's right. So there's zone 1, and zone, the buffers have two parts basically. And so the zone 1 is the interior, is the beginning part of the buffer measured from the banks of the stream or the center line with regard to ephemeral streams and measured out a distance noted here. So with regard to watershed buffers on perennial streams, there's a 100-foot buffer from on both sides of the stream,
okay,
measured from that location. And then the entire buffer within, there is no zone 2 buffer essentially in the University Lake watershed.
Right, okay.
I should put that up there.
On attachment B15, the second one, it references greenway and hiking trails.
Yes.
Does that have any implications for planned greenways and trails in Carrboro? And says greenway hiking trails designed and maintained to maximize nutrient removal and erosion protection, minimize adverse effects on aquatic life and habitat, and protect water quality to the maximum extent practicable. And at the bottom it says, to the extent practicable, greenway easements shall be located a minimum of 10 feet from the top of the bank, and surfaces shall be a minimum of 15 feet from the top of the bank. Will that affect our greenway planning at all?
Well, I think it will help guide our greenway planning, since we are primarily at the conceptual planning stage, not
that,
the construction planning stage yet. This information will guide us. The table does the X in the allowable part of the table over here indicates that this is a type of use that is permitted, but there has to be a no practical alternatives determination made. So there'll be a package of information that has to be prepared to, if we are going to be located, I mean, if we're going to locate any greenway or hiking trails in buffers. So it will guide us. The provisions about the separation requirements, the desired separation from the bank and this water body will guide the construction drawings, I think.
The Greenways Commission just actually heard last week a presentation on this, two presentations on this particular topic. But suffice it to say, it's even more complicated than Trish is making it out there, and that there was some guidance that, for example, in areas that are already disturbed, it's probably better to use areas that are already disturbed rather than disturbing new areas just in the name of being 30 feet away or whatever. So not to say that they would necessarily approve one thing or not, mm-hmm, not approve another thing, but just to say it was clear that it would end up being a very nuanced decision on the part of the DWQ staff.
So okay. Does that mean that the assertion that was reported, I guess, in the paper about a month ago, that the idea of paving along Bowling Creek would run afoul of the Jordan Lake rules, that's not as clear-cut as people were asserting?
Well, I think if it was as clear-cut as it was asserted, then there wouldn't be any greenways being built anywhere in North Carolina. It's basically okay. What it would boil down to, and that's not the case at all.
But it also means that you have to look at alternatives and see if there are alternatives available.
It's just to say that the staff's presentation, in particular at our last Greenways Commission, made it clear that this is a complex topic and that DWQ would weigh a lot of different factors in thinking about how to, you know, taking into account decisions like, well, is it better to use an existing disturbed area versus mandating a certain particular number of feet away but winding up causing more clearing, okay, that type of thing. Anyway.
Thanks. So the DWQ has asked has stated that they're expecting an action by the town on this within 2 months of their approval, which took place on September 9th, which would make our action needed by November 9th.
Move the resolution of consistency.
Well, go ahead. Finish what you're doing then.
I'm just making a motion.
Yeah.
Second. Okay. Is there a comment on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that in addition to the work that the town of Carrboro is doing on conservation and restoration, when Tom Kors of Friends of Bowling Creek presented, I just wanted to highlight and remind folks that he mentioned that Friends of Bowling Creek is also looking at the current practices and the ordinance and the maintenance of the practices, and that over time this is something that needs to be consistently monitored because the conditions of the creek do change. So I just wanted to remind folks and highlight what has been said.
Thanks, Randy.
Mr. Mayor, you might want to see if, since this is a continuation of a public hearing, you might want to see if there's anyone.
Oh, we don't have anybody signed up, but is there anyone who wanted to comment at the public hearing? Former Alderman Bryan.
Thank you. I don't have what you have before you, so I may be talking about a version that has been corrected concerning the proposed rules. But looking at 15A NCAC 2B .0267, under purpose, just to draw your attention to the last line under one, if it's the same as on your document, that local governments subject to this rule may choose to implement more stringent requirements, including requiring additional buffer widths. I assume that you all know that. The portion of the rule that I wanted to just briefly has to do with forest harvesting activities, which are... to point out that there are regulations here that allow for extensive forest harvesting activities within our buffers. And the issue came up a year ago, maybe longer, along the Bowling Creek portion to the west of Old 86, and clear cutting that was taking place on the Blackwood, I think it's the Blackwood property. That was quite extensive and extended, as far as I could tell from the eye, into what I thought were the buffers established by the town. When we explored that, the town actually told us that it was a forester that was in with the county that had to take a look at it. Bottom line is that the regulations that they were saying applied were these Jordan rules. So in terms of, and I, again, you may not have this in front of you, but there are requirements specific to forest harvesting operations that allow for cutting of timbering and various harvesting of dead trees and removal of individual trees and so on that apply where a forestry management plan is being submitted. The question for the town, in my mind, is to make sure that in order where people are clearing along something like Bowling Creek and using this section as a justification for going into the buffers that are established by the town, that you have a clear idea of what they are supposed to be able to do or not do under these Jordan rules. Otherwise, anybody can say that they're clear cutting for forestry purposes or for whatever reason, mm-hmm. and not be able to follow whatever rules you put in place. So I think it bears some, and Trish has reminded me that you all have looked at or have passed some amendments to the land use ordinance regarding stormwater and so on, but I don't know what you have that it's in place regarding forest harvesting operations. and how to handle the tension between clear-cutting and protection of both the creek buffer areas and riparian areas.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
Trish, does the...
Hey, my hand was...
We're down here.
One of the questions I have is if someone was going to do clear-cutting or forestry, would they have to file something with the town or have some paperwork with the town prior to them engaging in the activity of cutting near the buffer?
Well, a forest harvesting is specifically one of the activities that is going to be regulated by the Division of Water Quality, not the town. And, I mean, because of the provisions of that were the general, there were some changes in the general statutes, and Mike can remind me, but in 2006 or perhaps 2007 that specifically exempted the local governments from regulating forest harvesting if someone did have a forestry management plan in place with their local extension forester.
Mm-hmm.
I think that may have been the case that we ran up against with the situation out on old NC86 last year, but and so our ordinance was amended a couple of years ago to make clear that provision that basically made it clear that we didn't have authority to regulate that mm-hmm. activity if someone did have a forestry management plan. But this is one of the changes that we've included in the ordinance, the buffer regulations that from the DWQ staff review is, and this is from the Jordan rules, that the authority or the responsibility for administering the requirements in association with forest harvesting goes to the DWQ, not to us.
And would we, let's follow up first.
Mm-hmm.
So then if someone had a complaint about someone clear cutting on their property and they didn't have a forestry management plan, where would a person find out where they would be able to complain? And if you didn't have a law degree,
well, get those people that complaint passed on to the DWQ staff.
Okay, so there's a method. We have an internal method of if someone should do that. Okay.
So basically, Jay's concern is not something we could take action on, even if we wanted to in some way. It's like out of our hands, under.
We have a provision in our ordinance that deals with clear cutting that is separate from this issue of buffer protection, which deals with the timing of development. And there is a bit of a stick in there that tries to prevent folks from clear cutting land prior to development, and then so they can go around the tree protection provisions and so forth. But I don't believe with regard to water quality buffers and specifically associated with the Jordan rules. Now outside of the buffers that come specifically from the Jordan rules. So on ephemeral streams, for example, if the town wanted to put in place some more specific buffer regulations that dealt with forest harvesting, I think we could do that. But this ordinance doesn't have that in there right now.
But even if we did, as long as somebody
That's right.
You can't if under two circumstances where they have either a forest management plan or they've got current value use forestry value property, whatever the
use value.
That's the word I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. Use value for forested property. Either one of those two circumstances, we can't regulate their forestry activities.
Mm-hmm.
So
I see.
Trish, on page B19 near the bottom where it says vegetation management, forest harvesting, see section 15-319(1). Is that what you were talking about, or is that something irrelevant?
15319.1 is, let me just pull it up here. I'm pretty sure that is the section that says, mentions the forest harvesting plan requirements and the exemption essentially from our regulation.
It kind of sounds like we can write a tighter regulation, but it's not clear who will really be practically regulated by it. I mean,
someone who doesn't have a forestry management plan or isn't in use value.
Right.
Would that be forest harvesting then?
Those would be mostly people with some pretty small lots.
Yeah. This is, yeah, so this is the regulation of forestry activities, and, you know, it basically encapsulates what the statutory change was a couple of, so this is dated, you know, but it was 2007 or so.
On the line on the table that Lydia's referring to, so should there be an X under exempt on that line on page B19 for forest harvesting?
No, if it were exempt, it would mean that it, well, I guess so. It means, well, I'm not sure. We'll just stop there for a minute.
It's just not regulated by us.
Okay, so it's some other category that we don't have a column for. Okay.
Yeah, I mean.
I think that's what it's trying to indicate is that it's not subject to that jurisdiction. I mean, we don't, it's one of those things that the state. The state has decided in its wisdom that it can do better than we can.
Again.
Shocking. Huh?
And sometimes you're not.
There's one other speaker. Oh, wait a minute.
How does the town know that somebody's clear-cutting does have a forestry management? And I'm not clear about that process, so you know that they can do X, Y, and Z.
Well, I think what we so do is somebody calls us and says they're chopping down all the trees out there, and we make an inquiry.
Somebody starts cutting.
Again, you got to distinguish
between. The planning department gets flooded with phone calls.
Yeah. I mean, you got two separate considerations. One is forestry activity within the buffers. The state says that's our baby. And the other issue is forestry activities outside of the buffers, which the state says is not your baby, local government. You can't regulate it. And so it would be subject to our jurisdiction if it were not use value property or a forestry management plan, and we would have to simply make inquiry. We'd probably just call them up and say, what are you doing, and make inquiry. And if we found that they didn't have either of the two exemptions, we'd probably issue a stop work order.
And then
I can think of a current example, the Leak property up near Fox Meadow where I live. They were doing some clear cutting there. And I know some folks in our neighborhood, I think, called staff and checked with the county or staff did and found that there was a forestry management plan in place and it was in use value.
And that's sort of what I'm saying is like all the, I'm sure that's true for that property that caused a stir on Old 86, too. I'm sure it's in use value.
Right.
That's probably part of the reason it got cut.
Right. And you have to have a written plan, and you have to get a forester to approve your written plan. And, you know, I can't just say, oh, this is the forestry management plan. You have to have somebody with recognized technical expertise that knows it, and you have to go through the county extension. I know
it's a whole thing.
It's a whole, you got to get on a list so that person can come see the property. So it's just not something that you can produce on your own.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, in the end of going through all that process, apparently cut down trees within buffers. So.
Well, I think it just depends.
And cut down your tax bill, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and then some people do it, speaking from experience. Do it because they have a particular plan, and if they're growing it to sell it, then some of it's going to be winnowed out so you could sell it. You're trying to protect the hardwoods and the pines that you intend to sell.
Right.
I'm not sure they can cut down on the buffers.
Right.
I mean, I think
right.
The state does require that right. certain buffers be maintained, but it's just they're saying you local governments are not administering
right.
that. We are. So I don't know. I think
so there exactly, is. A, so there is some.
I think there is protection for
yeah.
the buffers, and the state does it. And in fact, I think the state forestry management plan requires that buffers be
yeah.
kept to some degree, but exactly to what extent,
yeah.
how wide, and all that, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's okay, we're trying to
we'll hope
anyway.
That the forestry management plans include that sort of thing.
So I'm sorry. One more question. Does
yeah.
that mean that are they sensitive to the Jordan Lake rules? That, in as much as they seem to be. Expanded versions of state rules?
Well, I can't say for sure, but I mean, what I do know is that, again, the Jordan Lake rules have exempted control over forestry activities within the Jordan Lake Rule mandated buffers. So presumably, they're doing that with the eye to controlling it to some degree. But whether it's as extensive or more extensive than the town would do, I really don't know.
I think they're hoping to do more than most towns would.
Yeah,
right. Hopefully.
That's a good case.
All right. Other questions on this item? Is there...
We have a motion.
Consistency. All those in favor?
Aye.
Signify by saying aye. All those opposed?
Move the ordinance.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded for the ordinance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passes unanimously. All right. Is that it for that item? That puts us on item B2, a continuation of public hearing to consider a map amendment for the Ballantyne property.
Okay. Thank you very much. This item is coming back to you. It's a continuation of the hearing that started back in September. And at that time, you opened the hearing and took public comments on this rezoning request to rezone a portion of the Ballantyne property, 8110 Old NC 86, from RR and R20 to R10 B3, Planned Unit Development District. The hearing was continued to allow additional time to consider the request, and back in September, you asked for some additional information, specifically the number of dwelling units that could be allowed under different zoning schemes and properties that are still potentially suitable for, that still would be potentially suitable for rezoning to commercial, considering the separation requirements of the B3 in relation to pre-existing business districts. So we have in your packet and up on the screen here a map that just shows the zoning districts. Zoning is R20, essentially up in this area of our jurisdiction. RR up in this part of our jurisdiction, R20 in this area, and all over here. Right about here. R15 down here, R20 over here as well. There is a small piece of B3T here, and of course the village mixed use conditional use zoning district over here at Winmore. We just broke down the property into the components of it that are in its existing zoning. And the property that we're looking at, which is a portion of the larger tract, 25.79 acres, a little over 1 million square feet, is 17.63 acres in RR, 8.16 acres in R20. The zoning on that, these are rounded down, these numbers, but you get 17 units on the RR portion, 17 units on the R20 portion under the existing zoning. The requested rezoning is the 23.21 acres to R10 and 2.5 acres to B3. So on the B3 portion, and these numbers are pretty much held the same through this part of the table, you get 14.9 or really 14 units of residential in the commercial portion of the property, and 101 units are possible on 23 acres of R10 zoning. One alternative is a VMU, just for comparison. It's very similar to the requested rezoning, and that it is made up of an R10 base residential zone and a B3T commercial zone. So again, these numbers are the same: 14 units of residential within the commercial portion, 101 units of residential within the residential portion. Another alternative is R15 zoning. It is a zoning district that is in relatively close proximity to this site. Again, at 2.58 acres to some type of commercial zoning, you'd get 14 units of residential within the commercial portion, and you would lower the residential, the possibility of residential units to 67 within the residentially portion, residentially zoned portion of the site.
Trish, what's the difference between B3 or B3T?
B3T is the is our B3 transition. It's neighborhood business for the transition areas.
Okay.
And it has a slightly different mix of uses, but for the most part, it's very much like it. The B3. Yes, they're both neighborhood commercial. Small scale, they both have an acreage limit and a distance
similar
requirement.
Uses, similar type uses?
Yeah, almost exactly the same. There are just one or two that are different.
With the BMU, could they potentially get more than the 101 units if they took advantage of the accessory apartments or the bonus commercial? So that would be up to their choice of how to apply it.
That is one of the, thank you for pointing that out. That is one of the differences within the VMU, of course, that within the commercial area, you basically get, whenever you have commercial apart units above residential units above your commercial space, they don't count towards your density. There is the same size limitation, so how much you can fit within it is the deciding factor, I guess, is how much intensity can go there. There isn't one other point, though, with regard to the VMU, is that accessory dwelling units in a VMU don't count towards density calculations. So, for example, within Winmore, there are something like 98 accessory units that were approved that can be built as garage apartments and that sort of thing on the lots there. So it can increase the density beyond the permitted density. And these numbers are gross density. They're not adjusted acreage net density, taking out the natural constraints on the site. And there will be some reduction in the possible density of a development on the site under any scenario. But
also includes the do those calculations include the 40% open space?
No, they do not. I mean, that does 40% open space doesn't in and of itself affect density, but the constraint analysis, the reduction for natural constraints does, and those there is some overlap between the features that are open space and the features that are that we use to do the adjusted to calculate the adjusted tract acreage.
Okay.
So this is a. Showing the responding to the second question, once if this property, a portion of the site, had a commercial, a B3 portion placed on it, how would it limit the possibility for other B3s or B3Ts to be located, and actually storefront use areas within a VMU, to be located within that 1/2 mile distance, which is the separation requirement part of the zoning district definition for B3s, and sure. And also within the standards for the village mixed-use developments.
So does that also include the VMU, you were saying, VMU storefront developments too?
Well, there's a similar separation requirement that is established for the storefront use areas to other commercial spaces. So there was a spacing, kind of desired spacing of VMUs so that they would have their storefronts at least a 1/2 mile apart.
And what's their rationale for that separation?
I think it's, well, the concept of the village in no small amount, I guess, is that whole kind of walking distance to a center. Oh, it's about pedestrian access and walkability. So that's sort of seen as a reasonable distance for people within that 1/2 mile distance to walk to a center, and then others to walk. Or maybe it's really actually a 1/4 mile distance. It is actually a 1/4 mile distance, which is the 5 mile walk. It's used as a concept for the design of village developments.
Right, I get that.
So you get adequate spacing between like transit stops, that type of thing. You know, in other words, so that it would seem to me that what the purpose or the effect would be that you'd have sort of specific spaced.
Right, but nodes. I guess, you know, my question really is, you know, say we approve this and say someone was putting a VMU or whatever our new mixed use will be when that time comes in Area C, and when they do look at the property and make their plans, it makes sense that the commercial should be in that cross-hashed area. Why, I'm not clear why we'd want to have the ordinance automatically preclude that, mm-hmm. rather than that be a decision we would make at that time in the context of a particular proposal.
And I think, adding to what Dan is saying, the rationale behind this doesn't take into account that there may be a token amount of commercial development that wouldn't necessarily warrant so much walkability. So let's say if there was a daycare center or that counts as commercial, or whatever, a coffee shop, it would just be for drinking coffee that there'd be walkability, but there'd preclude walkability for all the other things that people need to do. So I would hope we could at some point revisit this and make it so that we can encourage village mixed uses that are diverse in what people need to access.
The B3 is a zoning district that's been in the ordinance since the commercial rezoning, I think, of 1985, if not before then. So it has had the separation requirement. And I think that, you know, the thinking at that time may have been, you know, to prevent strip development, to sort of limit, to not see multiple B3s occurring next to one another and, you know, kind of it becoming one continuous strip. And also, there was a very intentional decision that the town made in the 80s when these zoning districts were established to really limit how much commercial zoning was placed in the town's jurisdiction, so that it would maintain the emphasis on those areas that they would maintain vital. It maintained vitality, rather. You know, the center of downtown, the commercial areas there, and as well as the two outlying commercial areas, the B4s. So there was a real specific reason to not have too many of them, and the spacing requirement, I think, helped accomplish that. But there is also the concept, just in the description of it, that you're trying to create something that's sort of at the neighborhood scale, and that walking distance or small distance kind of makes it fit with that neighborhood scale. It's kind of lived out too, because as we saw later in the 80s and into the early 90s, when the new urbanism was really taking off, that 5-minute walking concept, quarter mile radius, was sort of seen as the way, which would, you'd have a quarter mile to each side, you know, of your, from one storefront to the other, and a half mile between them.
So Trish, if the owner of Area D or C came to us years from now and came in with some type of commercial type idea, how does a decision today to go with B3, how does that restrict the possibility of working with that in the future?
Well, the specific limitation would come from the if they were to seek B3 or B3T zoning, and I believe Area D is just large enough to do what we have in our ordinance now as a VMU. I believe there's 50 acres there. But and Area C, I don't think is in and of itself, mm-hmm. if it were combined
as VMU,
with
VMU.
Right. But so unless someone asked for B3T or B3, I don't think there's a problem with this going forward and limiting it, because, I mean, there's the possibility we could try and create another, and this conversation may lead to us doing that, or the conversation about the Eubanks Road property, the design workshop may lead to us identifying the need for some other type of small commercial that is doesn't have this kind of distance requirement, or modifying the one for the B3 if we like that zone as it is.
Or B3T is, I mean, this is the transition area.
Yeah, a zoning designation, you know, that wouldn't restrict it quite as much as this one does, maybe could come out of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we have a couple of options for.
Well, is it possible to modify the ordinance so that the half mile remains the standard, sort of the default standard, but we have the option to grant to approve a different plan under the CUP?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, I would like us to explore that as part of the NSA update. What do you all think? Mm-hmm. Are you all open to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a motion.
Second.
Second.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, it's been moved and seconded that we refer that issue
to the planning staff
as
part of the NSA update.
The NSA. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. All right. So talk to me about another part of this project. You're saying, can you go back to your slide where you showed the number of dwelling units? Okay. So at the bottom of the VMU column, it says 101, but as y'all discussed, it's really 101 plus potentially.
It is.
Potentially lots of other small units.
I mean, except VMUs have this 50-acre limitation, and so we're sort of assuming that this is a, you know, this piece that we're talking about is only 25.7.
So it doesn't even qualify, really.
It doesn't qualify, but anyway. It's. I just wanted to.
Right, that's a good point.
Unless you change that, you could change that.
When you obviously we could modify that rule if we were interested in doing so, but there could be lots of other impacts from doing that too. But on the column where it says existing 34, does that amount to the number or about the same number that that we had previously approved for whatever this is? Whatever this used to be, phases 2 and 3 of the subdivision or whatever?
Only 17 or 16, 18, I think.
Or 18 units approved in the original approval.
Okay, thank you.
Applicant, and also a member of the audience.
They're 18
agree.
Approved.
It's 18.
On.
Okay. So, okay. So that's the comparison.
There was no development shown in that portion of the site that is up where the sort of the arm on the upper portion.
Okay. I see a number of people in the room who live not too far from this site. No one signed up, but I have a feeling that surely somebody must want to speak.
Can I ask a technical question?
Sure, yeah. Ask your question, then I guess the applicant's indicating he wants to speak as well, obviously. Hold on just a second. Jackie, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just following up with Mark that under the original plan, they could have put 18 units in this space, right? And then the board requested and suggested that they might want to look at putting some commercial in there, right? How do we get?
So we wanted them to look at putting commercial.
Yes, the board wanted. That's what I said.
Okay, just clarifying.
How did we get from wanting commercial to an extra 101 plus housing units?
Well, I guess
how did that happen?
This project dates back to 2004, I guess, and
yes.
when it originally came forward for it, or there was a rezoning request made to the board at that time prior to the CUP being finalized, the CUP application, and at that time, the planning board and the board of aldermen both, I guess, conveyed to the applicant, the owner, that R20 didn't really achieve an amount of residential density that seemed in line with what the town was seeking in the northern study area, and so in looking at a combination of zones that would achieve the neighborhood commercial idea and also respond to that earlier request because they are not inconsistent with one another. The R10 was identified as a zoning district that would achieve that, would provide more rooftops, more people who could walk to a commercial area, could support, make a commercial area viable, mm-hmm. and take advantage of the wonderful location here next to a beautiful couple hundred acre right. park and two school sites. And so it was a combination of looking at what had happened in the past, the viability of a commercial piece as the board had discussed with them last year.
But it's only 16,000 feet commercial, is that?
That's what has been proposed, because there is this 10% limit within the B3 in a planned unit development. And if there were a village mixed-use project proposed, if there had been a village mixed-use project proposed on these 50-plus acres, just over 50 acres for the entirety of the site, we would have seen only 10% of that site as well in commercial, so a little over 5 acres would have been possible.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Okay. Let's hear from the applicant and then from other interested parties.
Hello. I'm Jeremy Medlin. I'm with MI Homes of Raleigh. I'm here before you again tonight to ask for your approval on this rezoning. We have been involved on the project for the past 12 years. Not 12 years, since 2002, and I've been working on the project for the past four. Mm-hmm. Historically, going back through my notes and old meetings, we did receive feedback from the Board of Aldermen and the planning boards and some of the other board members that more density was, you know, desired here in this location. The area, as you know it, and as I know it, has changed significantly in the past couple of years. You've got a beautiful park proposed in the future to the north. You've got a brand new school farther to the north and a new greenway trail that makes this project more suited and more desirable for the increase in density. Since we purchased the property, we went from a single family home builder to a single family home builder and a townhome builder. And so that has become more appealing to us. And given the buffers that cup the majority of the site, it's a really beautiful piece of property that I think a lot of people could benefit from. And this would be a good fit, not only for the town of Carrboro, but for MI Homes. And like I said, this is a partnership, but I need your approval tonight to move forward to the next step, which would be to do additional planning, to prepare CUP, and work with you and work with staff on coming up with a very good site plan that would fit in well with the community. You will note that we added some dimensions there to show some separation. There was some concern from the Legends folks about how close this proposed development would be to their homes. And what we've shown here is in several areas it's well over 200 feet. The vegetation there is mature. It's nice big evergreens and deciduous trees of big caliber. And again, I don't think that this will be over 100 townhome units. I think it's more along the lines of 55 to 75 townhome units, and then a nice commercial component. It won't be a strip mall, but I think it'll be three or four nice businesses or shops that people could cultivate business with. And another reason that we're here tonight is because of change, and that's lifestyle changes that the economy has dictated to all of us, regardless of what your business or lifestyle is. I mean, we've all had to make changes, but what has not changed is that MI Homes wants to be here in Carrboro, and we've got a vested interest here. We've been working on this project for 8+ years now, and this would cultivate our relationship, and we'd be here for several more years working on this and then and being part of your community. And that's all I've got to say.
Okay. Jeremy, so you're talking about the townhomes that would be on that area around the commercial. Is it going to be all townhomes that we're looking at on that section?
Well, what is proposed here is hypothetically, if you can read the small print, is we believe it's somewhere between 55 and 75 townhomes, 16,500 square feet of commercial.
Right.
With around 10 flats up above the commercial.
And it's probably too soon to say this, but do you have any idea price point of what you're looking at?
It would be too soon to tell, but hypothetically, the townhomes would probably be around $200,000 to $225,000.
And how does that compare to what you would have built under the current plan?
The current plan is approved for 18 80-foot wide lots that would probably be, you know, $600,000 to $650,000 homes, I would guess.
How much more do you prefer the smaller lots and houses than those bigger ones in this economy?
You mean, are they easier to sell?
Yes.
I think they're, like I said, people's lifestyles have changed. I mean, they've changed the way that they live and what they purchase. And yes, they would more than likely be easier to sell. I don't know that for sure, but I would suspect.
Jeremy, on the original plan, there was cluster townhomes in the lower quadrant.
That's correct.
And that remains.
Yes, this phase one and phase two are actively under construction right now.
Okay.
And the infrastructure is going in, and hopefully early spring we'll start our first home.
All right, great. Thank you. Albert, did you want to come on up?
I haven't listened to this thing seriously three or four years. I did review this for a home association. There was a cluster, I think it was 50 or 50, 60 townhomes down here?
It's 34 townhomes.
34. And then there's a lot there, about 1.15 acre lots?
Those are 44, they're probably 7,000 to 8,000 square foot lots.
Yeah, this is what these houses are. These are 0.12 acre lots here, very tight, you know, that's what's built in here. And there's the townhomes are here, and there's townhomes here, okay? The problem that I could see here is that I don't think that you'd have a lot of opposition to it if we knew what they were going to build. This is like a pig in a poke. Let's change the rules so we can build what we want, but just trust us. And I don't think that's something, you know, if we came back with a concept plan, I think there'd be more meat on this to look at. You know, you're looking at possibly, for tax was at 100 and some odd additional homes plus an additional 60 accessory apartments. It's sort of like, what do we really approve? What are you really approving? The question is, I think the community would really like to see more meat on what are you approving, not oppose anything directly. And I personally find this Wolfram Village up here kind of silly, because if you look at Windmore, hasn't sold its village. And I know everybody here drives to Carver Plaza or Timberline. They're not going to, because they want grocery stores, what they do. And there's not enough size to support a village, reality, and housing. There are 463 homes in Hogan Farms, totally. And there's about, I think, I don't know how many Windmore has, but there's a 64 in Lake.
Five or six.
Yeah. So that's the total residents in the area. And this is pretty tight, okay? It's nice, but it's not, you know, wide open to your suburban lot with 2 acres of land. It doesn't exist there. There are some at Hogan Farm, but a good part of Hogan Farm is also, they have the Town Ridge townhomes. There's a whole cluster of townhomes over here. There's a circle you saw, which is the village homes, which are on about 0.15 acre lots. They're not very big, and they have green space behind them. And then there are a third acre lots, a half acre lots, and a couple larger lots. And that's the way it goes around here. So I don't. The other issue I have is with the Wyndham proposal. I have a lot of apartments. I look at it from town, from Carver's base. Carver has over 70% of its properties are rental properties. Mm-hmm. It's really getting disproportional to rental properties. I really think there should be some thought of balancing what your community is. Okay, and that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Sir, anybody else who'd like to speak on this item?
Mayor Chilton, could we make sure that folks come to the podium and to speak?
Oh, yeah.
Because it's difficult for the audience at home to hear, plus for our recording purposes.
Well, I figured Albert's such a loud mouth, people could hear him. But it's a good point, Mr. Manager.
My name is Jeremy Finch. I'm with the John R. McAdams Company. The consultant has worked on this project for as many years as Jeremy mentioned, and I just want to touch on a couple points that Jeremy already said, because everybody seems to be getting bogged down in the allowable units. Those 101 units are obviously the maximum allowed under the new zoning. It's not, by the time you take out all the green and the constraints that we've talked about, you know, this project won't yield you know, 101 units. You're looking more, what Jeremy mentioned, the 55 to 75 townhome units. And also, just to be clear, I know we've talked about this before, this does, we don't walk away tonight if we get approved, you know, with a free pass to build without a, you know, coming back to the board. We'll be back in front of the advisory boards with a full CEP permit, be back to the aldermen, we'll be back to, you know, the town, the residents will be able to come back to a public hearing and see a full details of a layout. So, you know, by approving this tonight, by no way will we walk away from here with a free pass to, mm-hmm. to do what we wanted to do on this property. It would come back completely to everybody involved for. So I just
want
to make that
distinction. That's
exactly.
Thanks.
All right. Is there anybody else who'd like to speak?
My name is Jay Bryan. The Northern Transition Area did, I think, presented you some recommendations about the rezoning. So I just want to remind the board of those. And those basically were that along the lines of what was already said about the town not knowing exactly what it would be getting, because this is not a conditional use district rezoning. It's a standard rezoning, which is not something that happens often in Carrboro. But it is known that potentially the site can lead to 4 or 5 times the number of houses or units that were approved in the original plan, which would cause, in our mind, significant unexamined traffic increases along Old 86, and particularly at this entrance, which is also the entrance to the park, and on a road that is already dangerous due to truck traffic for construction, buses, other speeding traffic. We've not had a lot of success convincing DOT to change the speed limit. So, yes, there's a long process once you rezone, but the thing is that you have to rezone first, and after that, then it's part of the process. Developer meets the standards or not. The key question is, do you want to rezone it to allow for this kind of density? And I understand that you gave some hints to the developer about that. In terms of commercial, I know you all had discussed about a charrette for another piece of property and whether or not that process might lead to more of what you're getting to or interested in. As far as this site is concerned, it seems a little bit odd to be there, although I understand that you want to get started with something. So why not do it with a project that is coming before you? I don't, other than to say that the NCPIRB process that we went through a couple years ago had identified a couple of other areas to look at for commercial development, including the property at the corner of Eubanks and Old 86. As I recall, the Blackwood property, so to speak, on the west side of 86, Homestead Road, the Hogan property that's off the potential connector road as sites. This was not identified per se as a site. The other issue I think that's unfortunate really for any of this development is that due to the economic downturn, the park hasn't been developed, and more importantly that the connector road, and in fact it is a connector road, it's not just a small road, it's designed to get traffic off of Homestead to get through to Eubanks for school and other traffic. That could be a potential source of relieving the traffic pressure on Old 86, but we don't know when that's going to happen, and I don't know when. So it certainly would be helpful to have that to help this traffic pattern relieve what might come out on a very dangerous intersection. So it's already dangerous, so this will only increase that. Thank you.
Thanks, Jay.
I just wanted to add one thing, that during the NSIPRC process, there was a kind of a conscious decision on the members of the committee, as I recall, to not include any properties that were actively pursuing CUPs at the time. So the Claremont, the Zins property, for example, at Claremont 2 was not included as one of the sites, although its location on Homestead Road was of interest to the committee as a potential site for some kind of mixed-use development. But there wasn't a recommendation made about that site or about this one. They were both actively pursuing CUPs at the time. So the point wasn't fully considered, I don't think, as to whether or not the committee wanted to identify this location as a...
we didn't want to get into sort of jerking the rug out from under somebody who's in the middle of the process.
Right.
But so meanwhile, the global economy has jerked the rug out from under us.
Sure has.
There's someone else who wanted to speak.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am. Come on up.
I'm Annie Hufrana, and I live on the property and have for 32 years on Old 86 that absolutely faces the corner. See, my right, Jay? I'm right here. Okay, this is my property from, so this road right now from Hogan Farm comes right to my corner here, and actually my family owns this property here too. So we go up to Deer Ridge. So clearly what happens out here is literally in our face every single day. And while I'm not at all opposed to a nice development, and I think what will happen here is a nice development, the issue of the traffic, the new traffic every morning now, okay, without anything happening, without no any more right here coming out of Hogan Farm, is very, very busy, very, very dangerous, and very, very active. So I think probably the most important thing that has been said today is Jay's point about the danger of Old 86 at this point. The school buses are on it.
Can you move a little closer to the microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry. The school buses are on it daily. Unfortunately, the trucks going to Eubanks are on it daily. Unfortunately, the buses that are not used on that road during the day, that's their off-duty route as they leave Carrboro and head to the parking site back behind Eubanks, as well as just major commercial trucks in and out every day. So the morning commute of citizens living in Hogan Farm on their way to the school or work or 40 or wherever they're going is active and dangerous. And I would propose that some of you sit at that corner at 8 o'clock in the morning and see people coming out and how it's all happening. So I would just like that to be the thought of another 100 residents in that neighborhood all coming. Now, they would come out a little bit lower, but they're still coming out on that site. I don't think the infrastructure is ready for it, and I'd like you to consider that aggressively. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I have a question for Jeremy, if you could come. I just wanted to clarify the point was made by Mr. Vickers about the balance of rental housing in Carrboro. Are you proposing that any of the additional units would be rental units? Are you considering that, or were those units you would sell and they would be owner-occupied?
We're not in the rental business.
Okay, and you're not proposing that some rental management company
no.
might participate in the project? Okay, thank you.
Yes.
As some of you know, my name is Bob Kirshner. I'm in the southern section of Carrboro.
I think I recognize you.
I'm here. I just wanted to come up in as a layman, support this recommendation here. I know that I foresee that Carrboro is just going to be expanding. This is up an area that needs to expand. We needed more of a commercial base in our overall scheme of property. The potential that this will allow is huge, even if there's small spaces. I just want to throw out, and when you think about concept, you can even look at good places like Boston stuff where you have the townhomes built on top of a storefront. So it's using dual space in that same amount of space there, which allows some sustainability as well, because somebody could be living in their space, go down to their mom and pop store right below, whether it's a convenience store or workshop or art store or whatever. So I'm in support of this. I realize that this is a zoning thing, and that based on that, it's allowing the 100 plus units, but does not necessarily mean that that's what's going to be built there or would be practical to build there once you take everything into consideration. And I do know that the concept is a separate process. So I'm in support of this. The one concern I have was the width of the area being a R10T, I guess it is, versus a mixed use, which I think had a lower area. I guess that's the distance that another business area could be built. Is that, would that be limiting business in the area by going with this particular type of zoning to the other areas, such as D and C? And would this be better served to maybe not approve this one, but modify the mixed use and apply that?
So that is the same separation requirement as what we were told earlier.
The
village the mixed use.
Okay, well, then let me retract that last thing. Thank you.
Anyway, good.
Thanks.
All right.
So I think we are addressing that, and as much as we've asked staff to look into it further. But to address the traffic issue, I'm not sure. I mean, phase one and two are already happening, and we won't be able to come up with a solution right now. So I would recommend that we refer that to the Transportation Advisory Board for them to perhaps look into. Or would that be the best way to address that issue?
I think
where we can ask staff.
Or staff. I actually think that to some extent, I think this is an issue that we'll look at further up the road as a part of our charrette or whatever we're mm-hmm. calling it. On that property up near Eubanks and Old 86.
It's county implications too.
It does, and I think, let me say this. What I really think is that what we need to do is develop a kind of shared vision on this board and in the affected neighborhood, among affected neighborhoods, about what we envision the profile of Old 86 and also Homestead Road and probably Eubanks and Rogers Roads as well, what that's going to look like, and try to develop that vision and then go to DOT with it. And I think it involves maybe basically like one travel lane in each direction. Mm-hmm. And maybe some traffic circles and some things like that. But one of the issues that staff has said that they intend to get into in the charrette up on Eubanks Road is how do you move away from a country road feeling that it has now toward something else that might be more pedestrian friendly, mm-hmm. Environment, that type of thing. So I kind of feel like we're about to get into some of those issues through that process.
So you're suggesting we don't need to look at them in the context of this application?
Oh, I think it's highly relevant to this application, to sort of what the scale of the rezoning here is, the fact that there's a problem, but exactly what profile we're going to end up going for along Old 86. This only has a very short bit of frontage on Old 86, I'll point out. Has a significant, depending on the rezoning, it could have a very significant impact on the traffic. But
As a minimum, I guess DOT has standards for when intersections become dangerous. Can we ask that they, or has, do they know if this is a dangerous intersection?
Well, there have been ongoing dialogue between the town and DOT about this intersection in particular and about numerous speeding and safety issues, right, on Old 86.
Because the sites are short.
Old 86 is
Jay and I met with somebody from DOT about that just a couple months ago. Trish, could you come back up for just a minute and take us back to the slide that showed? I have another density question. When you showed those comparative densities, compared to allowable densities. So now, for the three columns that are not the existing, you looked at the allowable residential density and applied that number across the whole site? I mean, across the entire acreage of whatever this application is?
Yes. Not the whole property, but just the portion of it.
The portion requested for rezoning, yes. Yeah, the subject portion of our hearing.
Yes.
And can you go back to the map again for a second?
This one or the other one?
Yeah, that one. Now the way it's labeled up there, it shows both of those two different hatched areas. It says residential/commercial. But my recollection from it says that, in other words, up by old 86, but it also says that in the larger portion in the back,
right
there. But my recollection from our conversation last time was that the thought was that the commercial component would be more up toward the front of this.
Right.
That is, but this is illustrative, and you can't base your decision. I mean, base your decision on this.
We can't. Yeah, this doesn't. None of that. None of this really binds them to anything.
That's right.
Because we're only in the proposed rezoning.
The planned unit development district that's created if the rezoning is approved is R10B3 PUD across the entire thing, and then when an application, a conditional use permit application, comes in for the site, you know, with a site plan, then the specific portion of it that's used for B3 and that's used for R10 has to be shown.
Well, here's
and then they're subject to the regulations that apply to each of those two different districts.
Well, let me tell you why I was asking those questions, because, you know, I don't know that we could necessarily do this tonight given the nature of what hearing we've advertised thus far. But another approach to this, you know, we could if you want to look at those as two different areas, the smaller area on the left or to the west, you know, we could rezone that to something like B3 or B3T or whatever, some appropriate zoning designation for that portion of the site, and then simply apply some appropriate residential zoning category to the larger area on the right to the east. I just put that out there. I don't know whether the board is interested in doing that, but if that were an approach the board was interested in, then, you know, that could be a.
So are you concerned that
framework for
that the applicant would want to put the commercial in the easternmost section rather than closer to the road where it would make sense?
No, that's not the issue. I just was trying to simplify the project somewhat. I mean, I think part of what the applicant has. Well, part of what the applicant is getting at here is that they're hoping the town will show what level of commitment the town has to the notion of a commercial component to this development before, and this goes directly to the point you were speaking about, Albert. I think part of what they're trying to do is gauge what the level of commitment the town has to having a commercial component is before they spend, you know, the money on developing site plans and drawings and so forth. So I'm just trying to think of a way to to simplify the conversation, to accommodate that to a certain degree, to show that we're serious about wanting a commercial component, and then
the other reason I was approaching it that way is because then we can just have a if we could agree to what I just said, then we could look at, well, how big is the rest of the site, and what residential zoning district is appropriate to it.
So Mark,
do you see what I'm
so
getting yeah,
at? Just to clarify, the section to the east, the striped section to the east, would revert back to what the rest of the property is zoned. Is that correct?
Well, I'm suggesting is we would take two rezoning actions. One would be on one part and one on the other part.
And what rezoning action would you propose for the larger part, for the part to the east?
Well, I think that's a conversation worth having only if people are interested in approaching the subject the way I'm approaching it.
But I think it sounds like you're working towards a good middle ground, and I would be interested in that.
I'm just trying to...
Yeah, I would.
Because I think what it gets... I mean, a big part of what this gets down to is how many dwelling units this board is comfortable having as an upper bound here.
But aren't we limited by... don't we have a percentage allowable commercial relative to residential, and for that reason we need to consider the two together? Is that how this works?
The answer is yes, there is a limit, percentage limitation that's part of this PUD zoning or rezoning. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but I mean there is a percentage limitation. Is it 5 or 10%?
It's 10%, but then the B3 I think can't exceed 5 acres anytime. I've got my ordinance to just double check, but I think it's a 5 acre limit on any B3s.
How big is the area on the left that we're talking about?
So it can only be so big.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I'm gonna reserve because Dan had his hand first.
Oh, that's so sweet of you.
But I'm next after Dan.
And I'm going after Jill.
Yeah, I just want to put it out that I'm comfortable with the applicant's proposal. I think they're trying to do something that meets the interests of the town. I think the number of units they can actually build there is really pretty modest compared to when we talk about density and transit-oriented development and, and mixed use that we really want to see in appropriate places. It's, it's much less dense than that. So, I kind of almost understand your suggestion, Mark, but I'm not seeing the need for a change from what they're proposing. So I just wanted to put that out. Joel.
My question is, what are the underlying assumptions are we making economically that the splitting of the two decisions would make them continue? And this has been a question I've had for a long time with all the sort of, when we talk about mixed use and commercial, what are the economic assumptions you're making that that would produce the result that we were looking for? That's my question to you. If you had it, if you said, well, I didn't think about that, and that's all right too.
Well, yeah, I don't necessarily. I was trying to think of a way to approach. Well, I guess I was assuming that there were not necessarily enough votes to approve this as a PUD rezoning, but I may be wrong about that assumption. I don't know. I have a list.
Oh, okay.
Randy, and then Lydia, and then
well,
Jack.
Okay. Yeah, I raised this question last time, and I'm really not sure. And the 16,000 square feet of commercial, I really wonder about the viability of that. One of the things that I think is interesting about the direction you started to vision in is that, were the parcel, the western parcel there, in like a zone for a B3, could that still have the residential with it?
Residential allowed in B3. I mean, not very much.
14 units can go on 2.5 acres of B3.
14 dwelling units.
See, because one of the things I think is interesting about the PUD, the way it's set up, is that that would allow for more residential right next to some commercial. And I'm really worried about, let's say it's just four little shops or something, you know, that that, you know, would have something, you know, it, when you cluster people living around something, it does, it is better.
I'm on it.
So is there a way that there, that the residential immediately in that zone could be bumped up?
I'm not, you know, we don't have to approach it the way that I suggested. I'm not comfortable with 101, saying up to 101 dwelling units there.
Right. Well, I think that right, and I don't know that it would be, you know, I kind of think that, you know, Jeremy, you know, are right that the it would probably be more in the 75 range. But I'm just wondering if, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of clustering, you know, the residential around the commercial.
Okay. Lydia.
I wanted to say that, like Dan, I'm in support of the project as the developer has proposed it. I understand a lot of the concerns have been raised, particularly the traffic concerns, as one who drives out that way a lot. But the developer has come back to us, you know, with a revised, you know, plan based, you know, on our direction. And we have tried to search for a way to, you know, just start to have some commercial in the northern transition area. And this is a start. I mean, it's a baby start, but we don't have many locations out there where we can put in some commercial. And I know the planning board, we talked about this. What is 16,000 square feet? We tried to visualize it. And we took it this way. I think Trish and I talked about this. If you looked at Main Street from, like, Armadillo Grill all the way down almost to Bank of America, that's kind of the length of those type of,
okay,
you know, if you had those little shops kind of height-wise, that's the kind of space we're talking about.
That's right.
And so I think this development, and I do share the concern of 101 units. I understand the developer to say that there's it won't be anywhere near that amount, and I'm not sure how we can gauge the accuracy of that or the holding to it of that other than good faith. I'm not sure how that works. But anyway, I just wanted to go on record with all of that.
Okay, Jackie.
I'm not opposed to this. I'm not opposed to it because it's not a CUP. That doesn't mean that I will approve anything that the developer brings before us. That's not true. We need commercial out in that area. The people that live out there need it, and people that live here need it. It's you cannot keep griping about traffic and not want commercial. And I think to have a strip, you know, the length of that block on Main Street sounds really nice. It's not that we're giving up control. I also like the idea of some housing up in that neck of the woods near the park that will be under $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that people can afford to go to the school. People can afford to live near the school and go to the park in places that cost under $300,000. Not that I think $300,000 is cheap, but I know that I know that it is.
Yeah, but find something for it.
Yeah. So I will support this, and I apologize to people who think I'm wrong on this, but supporting this change is not the same thing as approving the final CUP, and I think the developers are hearing loud and clear from us that we want something that will not be intrusive. We want something that will have a true commercial part to it, and that will respect the neighboring area. So I would support it.
I don't know if you remember this, Dan, but you are next on the list.
Yeah, I have about three quick points. One is, well, the chart's not there, but currently the zoning allows...
Take us back to the chart, if you...
34 units, and the CUP, approved CUP is for 18, and it doesn't necessarily apply, but, you know, if the same proportion applied, given, you know, the all the constraints and whatnot, then you would get from 101 to down to roughly around 60 actual units. So I want to make that point. For me, you know, sitting on the transit committee, I feel like this is an area of Carrboro that we really need to bring bus service to, and we're never going to have bus service until we have population where we can have the ridership that's going to sustain it. And, you know, this little bit of extra, which is really a little bit compared to, you know, all of Lake Hogan Farms and Winmore and whatnot, but this will help us get there, and that's important to me. And I guess the final point I want to make, Mark, is if you do want to continue pursuing the proposal of separating it, you might ask the applicant, you know, if he has any comments on that.
Sammy.
Can I hear the, is it possible to listen to the applicant's response before I comment?
Sure.
The way that I understand that your ordinances are written, I don't think separation is a is an option that's permissible. I mean, it, and keep in mind this PUD process that we're under right now, it's taken me a year to get to this point. So I've extended my hand. I'm asking for your help. This is a partnership. This will not be the last time you ever see this. I promise you, because through the CUP process, I'll be back here in front of you. I'll be working with your staff. And to me, I understand about the concerns about 101 units. The 101 units does not fit with what we intend on doing. And I can just tell you that. I can, you know, as we go through the CUP process, we can demonstrate that and show you exactly how many units you'll have. But again, I think we're skipping a step. But I do need your cooperation tonight.
Okay. So I
think I'm understanding, like he is, that we can't really, I mean, the 10% of this property is what allows us to build that amount of commercial. So I'm not sure if I understand whether...
I was talking about doing something other than a PUD approach.
Oh, okay.
But it doesn't sound like there's very much interest in it, so...
But one of the values of taking that approach is that it would reduce the amount of area that would be constrained by commercial, and as much as that footprint would be surrounding a smaller area, I think. The point of the primary constraints that are on that property and that it really won't be 101 units is something we should bear in mind. One thing I understood through how this process is developed is that this is an avenue that we're taking so that the applicant doesn't have to come back and have a more extended process, which might happen if we were to go down the other avenue. And I do feel like this is a project that would, provide all the things that we've been signaling to the applicant in regard with higher density and being on a transportation corridor and the mixed use as much as we can. So I am in favor of this proposal.
Okay, I'm the next person on the list. you know, I mean, based upon what y'all are saying, what the sort of accommodating comments that you're making about how many units it'll really be matches closer to the R15 zoning district than the R10 zoning district. Put that out there, because under R15 that would be 67 units max. Mr. Attorney, could Madam Clerk, this item is specifically billed on the agenda as being considering a rezoning to R10. Does that mean that we can't consider a rezoning to R15 tonight?
I would say it does not mean that. I think without the general principle is that you can, if a request comes in for a more intensive zoning, you can rezone it to something that's less intensive without re-advertising it.
Because obviously, basically, the public on notice at some level that some rezoning of this nature is under consideration. Well,
the theory would be if there was not an objection to R15, no, to R10 zoning, then a lesser density would also not be objectionable.
From the public's point of view, not necessarily from the applicant's point of view.
Yes, yes. I mean, obviously, it would be something.
I noted that also when we look at the numbers. I think that's a very reasonable suggestion.
Me too.
What?
Can we hear from Jeremy?
To consider doing it with an R15 rather than an R10.
Can we hear from
the applicant comment on that?
And it's the same amount of commercial?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Commercial amount is not related to the density.
It has to do with the size of the
track. Right. It has to do with the size of the track.
Okay.
To be completely honest, I'm not sure what R15 exactly means because I don't know what that will do to us, what restrictions that it would impose on us. I don't know how to grasp this, so I'm asking tonight for you to approve R10. I understand that it's around 67 units, but if we're somewhere around 55 units, yes, it fits in that, but we could have a few more. I am asking for R10 tonight because I don't understand the dynamics of R15. I was not prepared for this proposition.
Mm-hmm. Can I
speak? You're the next person on the list. Yes, ma'am.
The only thing I would say to the board is that, first of all, I'm comfortable with voting for R10. And I'm comfortable for voting for R10 because we're always very strict and hard on developers. And, you know, and I don't know, I mean, that's the town's reputation. And all it gives him is the possibility of coming and putting a plan CUP down. And if we don't like it, as we have done before in many other times, we have said, no, we're not going to do that.
It's definitely not a rubber stamp.
It's not a rubber stamp. And I think, you know, if we had said to the people that own the property and the people that are trying to develop the property, we're thinking about R10 and R15, then they probably would have been prepared to deal with a conversation about R15 or R10. And I think in this process of us asking people, which we did, to consider commercial, and they looked at it, I'm presuming, on a universal basis, then it's sort of unfair to say, I mean, I know it's fair, but kind of it's unfair because then you're unprepared to say, let me give you an enunciated reason why or why not you should do R15 or R10. Mm-hmm. I just think that is. My other thing is, if you look at the town, you might want, and I agree with Jackie's point, folk who live in a house that costs less than $300,000 being able to go to the newest county park. And, you know, I mean, it's the board's decision, but I, you know, after all the discussion that I've heard here, I'm prepared to vote on it tonight. You know, you can vote it up or down, and then he'll know, and he'll decide what he wants to do. But I think, to me, sort of, I don't know. And again, you know, a vote for this particular zoning is not a vote for 101 units.
Right. Right.
And that's a distinction.
That's right.
That's right. With some, if I will, some heft behind it. There has never been a plan since I've been on the board, and before I've been on the board, I'll say this and I'll be quiet, where the developer has Well, you know, I won't say never, but it hadn't happened in the last 13 years, so I'm not expecting it to happen in the next year and a half.
You mean being quiet?
No. that's never going to happen until the Lord takes me home. But that we have ever approved anything that was exactly the way it was when they had filed it. Never. Never. There may be some, and the new clerk, can, that can be her new research thing, but I don't think it's
happening. Anything else to do.
We'll keep coming up with these great ideas for the clerk.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I want to point out that, you know, if the number of units came back too high, I think we can be pretty confident that we will have sworn testimony from neighbors about the traffic problems caused thereby, and we will have justification for a further discussion on that. But that said, I'd like to move the resolution of consistency.
Second.
All right. Resolution of consistency has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously.
Move the ordinance.
Second.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second for the ordinance as proposed with B. It essentially is the
attachment B1. Right.
But I mean the zoning effect is
R10B3 planned unit
development. Combination of B3T and R10. Okay. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Nay. The matter passes 6-1.
There you go.
Okay. There is your answer, Jeremy.
Are we going to take a break for a few minutes, or should I take my own break?
Well, I think we're entitled to a bathroom break. We've been here more than
okay.
9 minutes.
Okay. We're going to take a 3-minute recess, 4-minute recess. Okay.
Your prostate. She's still got to come back, but we got a quorum.
This meeting's called back to order. Trish, continuation public hearing text amendment related to flag lots, minimum lot widths. Lay it on
What's
us.
What's a flag lot?
A flag
lot.
It looks
like a flag. I mean, I thought the same thing.
It has a flagpole driveway and then a big flag field home site.
Oh, really?
See, Valentine started looking like a flag development to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, okay. Right.
Right. There is a definition in the ordinance.
Yeah, but, you know, the words.
No, I think
some, people are, some people are visual people. Visual learners.
Can you just remind me how we got onto this topic? Or how it is that we came to schedule an agenda item on this?
Sure. Absolutely. I will do that. Right here. So at the public hearing on June 22nd, when we had included within another an ordinance that had miscellaneous text amendments on a couple of different topics, the board considered an amendment that involved a change to the minimum lot width provision in the ordinance. And that change was to limit the uses on a lot that didn't meet the minimum lot width to single-family homes.
Okay. And that was passed?
That was not passed.
Was
you
not passed.
You approved the ordinance with the exception of that section.
This was part of, you remember we had kind of a hodgepodge so of this, different, this was one of those.
Here's what I'm realizing is that I was in fabulous California on June 22nd, 2010, I believe. So that's hence my problem. Okay, go ahead.
So this was a component of that hodgepodge ordinance. The board asked us a couple of questions about the ordinance, but decided not to adopt that provision. As we considered the item during the summer and the early fall, we really clarified what the problem associated with lots that don't meet the minimum lot width are. And so made some additional changes to the amendment or additions to the amendment to offer to you for your consideration, and are bringing them back for your consideration tonight. So why are these changes proposed? We have seen many lots created over time without any public review, without any provision of recreational facilities or open space, without sufficient infrastructure. And so doing these lots, and these are since there's not a public review, these are lots that are approved through the staff review process. These lots are significantly different from the types of developments that you all approve in larger, you and the Board of Adjustment approve in larger projects. And the pattern of development is somewhat haphazard. They create, not in every instance, but in many instances, less than ideal situations that are dealing with the provision of public services, whether it's public safety or picking up the garbage. They have driveway locations that are inconsistent with neighboring lots, existing developed lots. There are sometimes safety and site distance issues that result from this, and there are aesthetic and architectural issues that result from this as well. How does this happen? It probably happens most often through the use of an exemption that arises from the definition of a subdivision, and specifically creates some types of subdivisions that aren't subdivisions and so can't be controlled by our ordinance except to the extent that they meet minimum standards. These subdivisions are not reviewed. They are just the staff writes approves that they are not approvable subdivisions, essentially. We certify that they are, but we do not approve these situations. And currently, the minimum standards that we use in our ordinance doesn't specifically define what the minimum standards or the standards for these developments, these subdivisions are, or these non-subdivisions are. And so the current provisions that we use to apply to evaluate them and determine that they meet this definition are lot size, access to public streets, presence and availability of utilities, and lot width, which in our ordinance is only a recommendation, not a requirement. In some places,
lot widths are requirements, not recommendations. So we have incorporated into our ordinance flexibility on that point. What's the town's role with regard to these types of subdivisions? Creation of new lots, I should really probably call it that. Is that we do not have the authority to change the statutory exemptions. There has been conversation over the years about seeking authority, I think there have been conversations with the board. We had provided you with a copy of an agenda item from back in 2001 when this point was discussed in relation to infill development. But it's generally acceptable for local governments to create minimum zoning standards, specify what they are, and to apply them in making the determination of whether or not a lot that's being created through this exempt process needs to meet them. And, of course, the town can require issuance of different types of permits associated with different kinds of developments. So the draft ordinance that you have in front of you still has in it the section that makes lots that do not meet the presumptive lot width standard eligible for single-family, one dwelling unit per lot uses only. And then it adds a couple of other provisions. First of all, it adds provisions that refer the approval of subdivisions with one or more flaglots to the Board of Adjustment and would only allow the creation of flaglots in those situations. It modifies the existing definition of minor subdivision to not include the creation of any new flaglots in consistent with that change. It revises the existing language we have in the ordinance dealing with flaglots, which currently is limited to flaglots located in historic districts. And it adds a performance standard that would be used to evaluate these situations, and the performance standard is related to access and effects on adjacent properties. It modifies the existing language regarding the permit level required for subdivisions to establish that the Board of Adjustment would have authority. The Board of Adjustment would have the authority for below their normal threshold of 5 units, they would go down to 2, the creation of one additional lot out of an existing lot. And then one thing to note is that the language that we have included in the draft ordinance in your packet related to this would need to read 12 or fewer lots rather than fewer than 12 lots. Just a wording that is more appropriate. We have some illustrative examples that are from around town. So if the neighboring streetscape issue, which is the aesthetic, architectural kind of thing, this is looking in two different directions on an unpaved street in town, and then a new project that went in, or a couple of homes that went in on lots that were developed using the flaglot exempt subdivision process.
So this would not be allowed now without going to the Board of Adjustment?
Right.
Okay.
Is that considered, those are considered flaglots?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, not the one on the left.
You can't really, okay. You can't sort of see it on the ground, it's platted out.
But I have an aerial.
There are little flag poles that go back to
this is
units
the,
in the back. Yeah.
So the,
that's so it's right at the end of Dillard Street.
Sorry, it's right in this area
right
here.
Okay.
Then there's a neighboring property as well. It's
on Hillsborough.
On Hillsborough, so across the street from Dillard, that went in, and then the view of that from with the lines, the flags that go out to the street.
Well, that's why they're called flag lots.
Right. That's the flagpole.
Like, that.
And the
yeah.
flag.
Right.
There's a reason that they run these lot lines in this way, and it's not just the question of access to the street, because at least under the existing ordinance, I think your access to the street could be potentially by an driveway easement across another property or that type of thing. They do it because OWASA has this requirement that if you're going to run a sewer lateral, in other words, not a publicly owned pipe, but your private little white plastic right. pipe to go to the OWASA main, it has to run entirely on your own property until it gets right to the OWASA main. Mm-hmm. And what this developer didn't want to do was extend the main from Hillsborough, pay for extending a public main from Hillsborough deep up into this property, and then tie them on with short private right. service laterals and instead ran these 10-foot wide or whatever they are strips out to Hillsborough Road in order to run, you know, whatever those are, like 400-foot long sewer lines, private sewer lines out to the road.
Would there be an opportunity to collaborate with OWASA to minimize this kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I'm not necessarily criticizing OWASA's policy about it. I'm just pointing out this, but this is the kind of thing that she's talking about when she says, you know, that the infrastructure of the town doesn't get built. In other words, you know, the extension of a sewer line would seem to have been a natural solution to this problem, and yet that's not what happened. And instead of a paved street, you get unpaved driveways or whatever. I'm just pointing out what's going on, really. I don't necessarily have a conclusion from that.
I really understand these issues and why staff finds it important to address them, and I appreciate that. However, I live on Maple Avenue on a flag lot. On Maple Avenue, in my neighborhood, there are 5 homes that have been built on flag lots, if you include one that flags off of Greensboro Street that abuts mine. There are 5, and there's going to be 6. None of the houses on Maple Avenue would be allowed to be built under this. My house wouldn't, Dick Bircher's wouldn't, the other ones down wouldn't, Dave behind me wouldn't, Dave Markowitz wouldn't. None of them would have been allowed to have been built. And they are not creating the problems that we're seeing mm-hmm. here. So I'm in favor of, you know, this is from totally, you know, my perspective on my street. But nothing on my street would have been allowed to have been built. And yet my street is not, we don't have these kinds of problems on my street. And if we implement this, then other kind of good infill, particularly in the older sections of town, would be close to impossible to do under these new regulations. So I feel like we're almost there in addressing it, but we don't want to throw the baby out with it with the bathwater.
Joel.
I was going to ask, Jackie, what are the kind of conflicts, for example?
Our street frontage is 10 feet. Not 24. Our setback is the same as everybody else's.
Okay, but I'm sorry. Does that only apply to an intended historic district, or does that apply to?
Oh no. Yes, I'm sorry. The standard in there is would not. That does not. That's the change in that part of the ordinance would not make those standards apply to all flag lots. It would only make those standards apply to flag lots going in and. In historic districts, if it is a historic
which we do not,
a neighborhood preservation district. Only we do not have any designated historic districts in town.
Maple Avenue is not a historic district. It is a historic.
It's a neighborhood preservation.
It's a neighborhood preservation.
Yeah.
Well, just to clarify that this point about it originally was flag lots and only addressed in the historic district, which we have none right now, technically right. historic district. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, one of the planning board recommendations was this section right here, simply flipping A and B, because B is kind of the greater, B kind of applies to everywhere, and then A would say, but in the historic district, here are further restrictions.
B1.
Okay. If and when we do have a designated historic district, which would be one yet to be built, I guess.
Lydia, I'm not following you.
Wouldn't it be okay. designated, that is to say.
it doesn't really apply to any historic district is already kind of here, you know? And so it doesn't really.
Then where does it apply? I mean, if it
what you're saying would apply to your subdivision. I mean, to your area, your flag. would only apply to what's designated as an historic district. So
we don't have, okay, wait a minute. We don't have any historic districts.
We do not. But when this language was put in the ordinance originally, it was part of the package of amendments that came in about 89 or 92 okay. or something like that, when the board was considering rezoning to historic districts.
And what you're trying to do is to make these apply throughout the downtown.
No, not at all. We're actually...
Let me take a stab at it.
Okay.
The language that you're concerned about in subsection A is already in the ordinance, has been in the ordinance for years. But since there are no historic districts in town, it really has no applicability anywhere.
Right.
The new language is under B. The new language is not adding to those requirements. The new language does not preclude the creation of new flaglots. The only thing that it does is effectively precludes them through the exempt process or precludes them through so-called minor subdivision process. In other words, new flaglots could not be created by going just to the zoning administrator or by filing exempt plats. You couldn't use the exempt process to create a flaglot, and you couldn't under this ordinance.
But you still could create the flaglot.
You could create the flaglots by going to the Board of Adjustment.
You could create the flaglot, and these three points would not.
They don't apply because we don't have any historic districts. I mean, so, I thought about just in drafting it. I thought about just taking those out of the ordinance since they don't really have any applicability anywhere.
Please. So what would apply? What would be the difference other than having to go to the Board of Adjustment? When you went to the Board of Adjustment, would they then say what? Because you're trying to address. How would that solve the problem if you have to go to the Board of Adjustment? There would be a
public hearing, and neighboring property owners would be notified, and the question of access and how your driveway is serving the lots and primarily that would be considered as part of the additional information that would be put in front of the neighbors who were invited to the public.
And then on what basis would the Board of Adjustment say yay or nay?
They would do what they always do, and what you all do when you look at a subdivision. They would look at the compliance with the land use ordinance, and then based on the testimony that came out at the hearing, they'd make those additional findings. They'd need to make those additional findings of fact about your request. Okay. This is very similar to the process that's used for the watershed subdivisions, where one lot, even if the two lots are created, it goes through that public hearing.
I think
process.
My issue is with the number of lots. I think if it's just one new lot being created, I don't think it should be bumped up. Mm-hmm. Because those aren't, all the pictures that you showed me, all the pictures that you showed us of the examples, that's not just one house. That's like a mini subdivision. So I think maybe.
But it could be one at a time.
For example, and this is the kind of thing, this is what happened on Hillsborough Road, I believe. That was actually two different exempt subdivisions on two different lots that were side by side, resulting in six different units that wind up on the side.
And I just think, which has been sort of a thing for me, is that we put a great amount of pressure on existing homes that are not in homeowners associations, which already have restrictive covenants, and so you can't create new infill where, for example, and all the people at Wexford would be mad at me, that maybe you would want infill as opposed to always putting it on everything that is below Lorraine Street and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's unfair. I think there needs to be some scrutiny so people can't do what they did on Hillsborough Road. And I mean, that's just my position. And so I'm in favor of it because I think it puts more pressure on the lives and people who live in existing neighborhoods who don't have a homeowner association. Keep in mind, I live in a homeowner association subdivision. And There's no, because the law wasn't in place and existing, this is one way, or the way development went, you just, you know, put a house up and then they all look the same or they didn't look the same, but you don't have a homeowners association. I think they are entitled to some of the same amount of protection.
I agree, but I think one is too low. I think it would be, you know, two or more.
We have one member of the public signed up to speak at this public hearing. Shall we hear from him?
Can I just run through a few more slides to show you, just to get to the end? And I also, you had also asked, I don't mean to, I normally wouldn't do that, but we also had a map that you specifically asked us to, or you had a question you specifically asked about existing lots and how this would affect them. And so we've tried to answer it for both kind of approaches here, just in terms of number and show you, if that would be okay. Okay, so just, and this is an example of a non-exempt subdivision that did some infill in a different way, maintain the streetscape. We have a couple of examples of this in town. We didn't show them all, but then there's an adjacent other exempt subdivision with flag lots associated with it for comparative purposes, and then an aerial view of the neighborhood. So that's off West Poplar. Other exempt situation.
So is that Laurel Avenue or something?
Yes. Yep. So again, as I mentioned, we proposed this summary originally, and we looked at the single family kind of limitation as a way to limit the intensity of this kind of changes occurring on lots that didn't meet the minimum lot width. But after, you know, further consideration, really considering the question in a little bit broader context, made these additional proposals for you. We have one pending application that's currently under review that would be affected by the ordinance. That is, we have one plat in front of us right now that involves the creation of flag lots. We recommend that you consider adopting these changes, and then the consistency provisions associated, the consistency findings as well. Planning Board reviewed the proposal last week and recommended approval. And if I could just pull up this other two maps for you. So the blue is the all the lots in town, essentially. Just those are based on their PIN references. And the yellow lots are lots that have that appear to have space to be subdivided based on the zoning districts in which they're located. So you can see a fair number of lots around town are big enough to, based on their zoning. This is, some of them have one lot on them, one unit on them now, but there is some room for them to put additional units on here. And then the second, sort of a more close-up version of that, we also have some lots that are essentially flag situations. We identified in going through an assessment of the lots in town like this, we found about 15 existing lots, existing flag lots, which I believe was Alderman Brown's question, how many lots might be affected by this change that we proposed back in the spring. And then there are about 40 lots that don't appear to be wide enough to accommodate creation of an additional lot along the existing street frontage, so they would have to be flags to support.
To be divided.
To be divided, right. Thanks.
15? Lydia?
Trish, one question and then a comment. So you can have a flag lot and have one dwelling unit. It's when you have more than one, that's when this would kick in, correct?
No.
No, they're separate provisions. One is that on a flag lot, they're limited to single-family uses, a single-family residence.
So you can't put a duplex on.
And you can't put
lot.
More.
Right, you're limited to one single-family house.
Right.
Okay. All right.
And then the separate question is if you are proposing a flag lot, then your procedure is different than it would be otherwise because it is by definition doesn't meet sort of the minimum standards.
So if you have more than one single-family or a duplex or more.
Yes, regardless, whatever you're going to put on it,
okay,
on the lots that you're talking about.
Okay.
But you would be limited on the flag lots to the single family.
Right, okay. Now, So just to the board, just to and maybe to our attorney to ask this question. Does it make sense to maybe flip A and B on the flag lot description? Because it kind of goes right into the historic district, and then it kind of goes into everything else.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that was. I was going to recommend.
So that was just.
Why don't we kick out that?
Except we don't have a historic district, so why is it even
right,
there?
So that could be eliminated completely.
So that one would
make it more clear.
It was part of the package of amendments.
Okay, well,
that you have to look in.
Okay.
Well, that was one.
I mean, if we are finding this confusing, I can imagine a homeowner coming in and trying to figure out what the hell's being said here.
Yeah. Well, let me recognize Ken Gorfel and see what the hell he has to say. Okay, and then we'll come back to Lydia.
Yes, sir.
I'm Ken Gorfel, and I think I'm a victim of bad timing here. I have been marketing a house for sale on South Greensboro for the last 2 or 3 months. It's on a fairly large lot that I was planning on subdividing. And I've had previous experience with staff where exempt subdivisions took 2 to 4 weeks. And so I wasn't particularly concerned about that. And I got I'm very close to entering into a contract finally. And so last week, I decided it was appropriate for me to go and apply for the subdivision. And I applied last week, and then the end of last week, staff informed me that about this amendment here, that it would include having to go before the Board of Adjustment on the creation of any new flaglots. So in a meeting with staff, they informed me that process might take, instead of 2 to 4 weeks, 60 to 90 days, possibly 120 days, and that would seriously jeopardize this potential sale that I have, and sales are pretty rare these days, so I'm here to ask for some relief if you do decide to pass this amendment for this particular plat that I have pending.
Please do.
How much time do you need?
I'm.
just line up long enough for Trish to sign the plat.
Yeah. I'm just asking. I mean, that's a reasonable question to ask.
Or maybe ask Trish.
How many units are you planning on doing there?
This is a single family house, and then there would be, excuse me, and then there would be two other lots that would be created.
Okay. Two other single family.
What's that?
Two other single family.
Right, but I'm not doing anything with those lots right now. I'm just concerned with being able to sell the house that I have on its own lot.
And you're going to retain the other two.
And the others would be for the future. It's not that I'm doing anything with them. It's just to be able to sell the house and convey title on the one third of the lot that I want to sell.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, Ken.
Lydia. Right. My other, just kind of to finish up, the planning board, the other concern, that question that they raised was with regard to Section B, again, that the one I was just talking about on Attachment B1, that the Board of Adjustment, so on, may approve flaglots if they conclude that the access requirements set forth in Section 15-211 will be satisfied. And if you go to that, it gives a, Trish, you might be able to help me with the language, but it's some type of a reasonableness standard as far as utility vehicles, public safety, to be able to get in, turn around, and so on. And the planning board kind of felt like there should be a set minimum width. I'm just telling you what the planning board kind of, they just had a question about whether that Section 15-211 was specific enough by way of reference here, or if there should be a exact minimum set. So I don't know if I explained that well, but
I think you did. That sounds right.
That was their concern. I just wanted to bring that before the board.
Can I ask clarification on that?
Sure.
Does that mean if there's one house on a flag lot,
that the trash truck would need to be able to get down that one house's driveway?
No, this is really about emergency access. It's about a fire truck or another emergency vehicle.
So it's no different than any other.
And you know, Marty said that there's a we use a 10-foot driveway, 10-foot wide driveway width provision as sort of the placeholder for that. So, but that is not referenced in the section that the planning board mentioned, which I can show you. And that's why they wanted to see something specifically there, because of the connection back to this situation.
Is the suggestion that standard go in this ordinance, or that the 211 be changed to have a specific standard?
They didn't say, and I would ask Trish what she thinks.
Well, I don't know if we've had any instances where the Marty can probably come up and speak to this, because he could respond to whether or not we've had folks resisting the 10-foot minimum and whether that's been sufficient. I believe he indicated as much to the planning board, but he can explain to you as well.
Good evening, everyone. The parking section, I'm trying to identify the specific section. I think it's 294. 294D, as in dog, specifies that driveways shall not be less than 10 foot in width, and as the mayor mentioned earlier, that conveniently fits with OWASA's requirements for a water or sewer connection out to a right-of-way. So the ordinance does cover it. It's just an indirect. It's not mentioned specifically in 15-211. So as we discussed at the planning board, I think it certainly wouldn't hurt to add some direct connection or specificity to 15-211, but the 10-foot width is in effect is already there.
Okay, and I'm comfortable with not changing that. I just wanted to understand it better, their recommendation. And one other question I have about this historic district language. Are there references to historic district elsewhere in the ordinance? I'm sure there are, right, in the land use ordinance? I mean, to remove this from here, would that then mean that this was pulled out, but there's still a lot of other references to the historic district elsewhere, right?
Yeah. There's a section on historic districts.
Just in case, someplace suddenly becomes historic.
To keep it consistent, would it be important to keep the Section A in this, or could it be removed without it being odd?
I think when Mike and I discussed it, we just thought it would be, best to keep it with the package of amendments that were used to create the historic district. If I'm not putting words into your mouth,
the planning board recommended reversing that, putting B in A's position and vice versa, and I think that would be a good idea for clarification.
I will double check and see if there's a reference to A and make sure we switch it to B if they do. If that's done. We can make that change in this ordinance. Is that correct?
Yes. And that's a non-substantive change, just flipping them A and B.
Right.
Dan, and then me.
Yeah, I guess my question is, if we continued this till November 23rd to get these minor changes made in the ordinance, and would that also give you time to resolve the plat of the gentleman who spoke before?
I suspect so.
Maybe that would be reasonable.
The other thing that would afford an opportunity for is I would like to suggest that we specifically contact and solicit input from nonprofit affordable housing developers in our community about the impact of this rule change. I can think of a number of developments that Empowerment Inc. and Habitat for Humanity and the Land Trust have at times used the exempt subdivision rules and used the sort of absence of a prohibition on flag lots to accomplish some things that are some important goals for us as a community. So I want to get some feedback about this.
And the other thing I'll point out is, and I mean, I'm not, you know, I just want to throw this out there as food for thought. I haven't come to a conclusion about this whole subject myself yet, but, you know, earlier we had MI Homes in here with their discussion of a big and complex and expensive project, the type of project that only a company like MI Homes can really practically afford to be engaged in. That is say, the kind of money that you need to have in order to do the kind of development they're doing is just beyond the scale of what certainly anybody in Carrboro, or just about anybody in Carrboro could afford to do. Whereas what Mr. Gorfkel is doing, and I don't know much about what Mr. Gorfkel is doing, but for example, he's the type of real estate investor who uses these rules, and these provisions are a part of his kind of financial investment toolkit. And I think some people in Mr. Gorfkel's line of work have made some bad choices at times. The one on Hillsborough Road is, mm-hmm. is a great example. Of maybe not the best choices from a city planning point of view, but on the other hand, it's sort of like, you know, if you legislate the local guys, the little guys out of business, mm-hmm. then you're handing the development agenda over to people with much deeper pockets, and probably not people but corporations who just don't bear the same kind of relationship to our community.
Here.
That's what I'm concerned about.
I understand that, but there's no scrutiny if you have an exempt subdivision for existing neighborhoods. Let's be clear about that. What are you going to balance?
Well, you know, for there's, example, I, and see, and I've done flag lot development, mm-hmm. on behalf of Orange Person Chatham Mental Health. It's not called that anymore, but that's what it was at the time. Mm-hmm. And to us, the fact that our development was exempt,
I know,
was. That's why we did it.
I know. You know, and in so that case,
you see what I'm saying?
I do just understand the cuts that, and way. I understand that. But on the other hand, the neighbors do have some rights. I mean, as my constitutional law professor would say, no right is absolute.
True. I just wanted to put those two things out there as kind of food for thought, and maybe we can take this up in November. Is that the plan?
Mm-hmm.
I can live with that.
I take it as a motion from
it
Dan.
Is
that seconded? I'll second it.
All right, so this public hearing is
continued
to November
23rd.
Right before
Thanksgiving. To November 23rd.
I was trying to suggest to y'all that we don't have a meeting.
All right, right before Thanksgiving.
Too bad.
I know.
All right,
you got all, the
all those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye. All those opposed,
aye.
Not passed unanimously. Okay. There's been a request for a closed session.
Can I ask one question before we go into the closed session?
Yes, ma'am.
Are we going to discuss the Chamber of Commerce initiative at some particular time?
You know, I just think it's much more, well, I'd be glad to. I'd be glad to.
Because I've got some opinions, as always.
I guess my suggestion would be it's easier to have a discussion about the future of economic development in Orange County after we find out whether
The sales tax.
Whether we have
that's fine. I don't have a problem
tax,
with
so.
Doing it after November. 4th.
Okay, so I'll take that as a motion that we set a time to for a discussion of this proposal sometime probably in November or early December.
I'll second that.
And I'll work with the manager to try and find out when exactly that might be.
I'm going to wait till January.
I just don't think the Chamber of Commerce is waiting until January.
But they got to get the money from somebody to run it. That's the other issue.
Well,
who's writing that check?
Well, guess what I'm saying is a bunch of other people are going to be running around talking about it, so I don't want to be too far out of date. But anyway, all right. So moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passes unanimously. So we'll schedule that sometime soon.
Move we go to a closed session for some unspecified purpose.
It's attorney-client privilege.
Attorney-client privilege.
Okay.
All right. Moved and seconded. Where?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Yes. Matter passes unanimously.
You mean George Sy still works for us, even though he graduated from